I partly was motivated to give this talk because Maddie and I are doing a workshop, and actually I talked with her yesterday, and she's really quite a creative teacher, so I encourage those who really are struggling with this inner critic or tyrant. Actually, can people hear me all right? I've never used this mic before. I should have asked. Is that okay? Okay. She's just got some really interesting techniques to work with this experientially. So, and actually, I got interested in talking about this inner critic or judging self or inner tyrant because I started seeing how pervasive it is in our culture. I gave a talk some time ago, and I made some little joke about how, you know, we're all kind of so concerned about performance and evaluation, and it kind of sets up this inner critic. And I asked everyone, I said, so does anybody have that? And the whole place just broke out in laughter. And then, you know, I co-lead this elders group. People are 65 and over. And, you know, I thought, well, maybe people might be worried about dying and their body falling apart. But again, one of the most pervasive topics is a sense of being inadequate and this harsh voice or thought that's always criticizing us. And in fact, yesterday we were talking about failure. You know, that was the topic that came up, and people were, you know, going back to their childhood and criticizing themselves for things they had done that they didn't think was skillful. So I think, you know, people here have some idea what this judging self or inner critic or inner tyrant is. You know, it's kind of a harsh voice or that drives us, sees us as inadequate, dismisses all our good qualities. You know, it sets up a lot of goals for us. You know, if we just tried harder, we'd be okay. And these goals, you know, usually we can't achieve them. And then even if we do, the inner critic isn't satisfied. It can't be satisfied. That's its role. It's sort of how it exists. By constantly setting goals, criticizing, dismissing you. It sees you without any love or compassion. And we can recognize this inner critic. One way to recognize it is the language it uses. It uses words like never, always. There's this comparison. Now, I was sitting up here just looking at it, all the people here, and you know, we kind of compare ourselves with each other or some standard that we're given, and everybody is so different. It's just amazing. And yet there's these images that advertising puts out about how we should look. And somehow we buy into that. So what is the source of this harsh voice, this critic, this sense of inadequacy? How does this come about? We experience ourselves somewhat incoherently. We have impulses that come and go. You know, our body feels good, and there's a, you know, there's a sense of pleasure, and life is good, and then we get sick or we're tired, and there's pain, there's aversion. Someone says something really nice to us, and we feel good about ourselves. And then someone blasts us, and you know, this is praise and blame. We don't feel so good about ourselves. You know, we do something, we make a whole lot of money somehow or something. We get a good job and feel great, and we get fired, and all of a sudden, you know, it's not so good. I mean, these are part of this is subjective sense, the felt sense of what we are. You know, really kind of what we identify as. And in Buddhism, in the language of Pali, it's the word is citta. which is sometimes translated as mind, sometimes as heart, sometimes as mind-heart. But I think heart really is, at least from my perspective, maybe the most appropriate translation for it. It's this quality, I mean, it's part of its emotions, but it's also qualities such as perseverance, confidence, determination, and maybe the flip side of those. It's this kind of intuitive knowing, this understanding that's not conceptual. This heart sense is really important. It's what drives us. It's what gets us here. It's what gets us to do things. We're touched by things. You know, we push things away. We try to get things. This is the heart sense that's driving that. It's just this felt sense of things. But outwardly, we want to present ourselves as a cohesive whole. We don't allow ourselves to show our vulnerability. We don't let people know a lot of things we think. We resist our impulses. So we try to present an image. This is part of the socialization process. We're trained to do that. We are given training to be a certain way in academia. And we get this from a very early age. In school, we get graded on how we do. We're supposed to perform a certain way. We get a job, and there's performance reviews. And how many people have had a boss that said, well, you know, you're really doing well. Why don't you slack off for a while? So we get these explicit signals about how we should behave. This is what we need to do to be accepted. So some of them are job-oriented, some are partner-oriented, some are very explicit, and some are subtle. You know, what clothes we wear, just how we hold our body, what the jargon is. Now, in meditation, we come here to kind of free ourselves of all this. But we want to fit in to be good meditators. You know, we come here and she wiggles. We're kind of weighing and measuring each other and ourselves. There he goes, nodding off again. A lot of people are nodding off in the sitting today. I mean, it's hot in here and people work. It's fine, right? I was going to do a guided meditation. I looked out and I thought, no, not tonight. You know, he doesn't have any guts. He can't sit very long. And so there's this way that we're held in by the group. And we kind of sit here and we don't want to we want to look okay. You know, at least not show our gross defilements. The pressure is enormous. We really don't get to reveal ourselves. And so we can't connect. So to connect means really to be able to be vulnerable. And that really takes someone that you can trust to be with. I had a friend who's been practicing for about 30 years, and he said, you know, I wish there was some way we could just make this lighter, that I could really say what's going on in my practice, because after 30 years, you want to look like you've kind of done it, right? But, you know, I've been listening to these Dharma teachers who you know, went over to Thailand and Burma, and, you know, when they were 18 years old, and they're about my age now. And, you know, every one of them is still working on it. So there's this tremendous amount of energy and attention into being a good object. This is the objectification process. Out of all this social conditioning, wanting to be approved of, to be seen as okay, the conceptual mind creates a set of standards about what will make you okay, what makes you accepted. And of course, we want to be accepted. It's perfectly reasonable. But it's so strong, this objectification process. There's so much energy and tension going into it that we lose touch with our subjectivity, our felt sense about what really makes us feel good. Now, we often don't even know how we feel. Oh, okay, you know. Or we dismiss it. You know, it's no self or not self, depending on how you want to translate it. So there can't be any subject, right? But there really is a felt sense. And we need to find a way into that. So we lose this ability to be aware and receptive of our immediate sense of how things are because there's so much energy going into being an object. And this objectification gets internalized. So then it's not just trying to present ourselves to other people to look okay, but we take on these standards, these ideas about how we should be. And we want to feel okay about ourselves. And it doesn't matter how much we do. Somehow it just doesn't fill us up. I have so many friends who have accomplished so much from a social standpoint. And I'm sort of driven by the same things when I was young. You know, I wanted to see how good I was. I went to a top-notch graduate school just to see if I could do it. I have friends who've done that. They're full professors. You know, they publish. But it's just never ending. So this sense of trying to be okay seems pretty good. You know, we want to be okay. We want to be kind and loving and compassionate. We want to realize fullness, truth. It sounds pretty good, right? But the problem is our whole lives are spent doing, fixing, accomplishing, and we're never really here. And we're not here. We can't feel good about ourselves. We're not in touch with the subjective felt sense. So how do we get off this track? How do we start weakening this harsh voice that drives us, that causes so much pain? Well, one approach is to ask if it's on our side. Now, it kind of feels, you know, like we should do all these things because somehow we're going to be okay, but is it really sensitive to how we feel? Is it aware of our body? Does it really see us from a perspective of love and compassion? Does it see all the wonderful aspects of ourselves? I remember when I first started doing loving kindness metta meditation. At first, I was just doing the phrases, and that felt pretty good, you know. You know, may I be safe? May I be happy? May I be healthy? You know, and then I listened to a talk by Guy Armstrong, and I remember he said, "Well, sit down and think of all your good qualities." And, you know, when you tell people to do that in a society, it's like, oh, yeah, but, you know, yeah, you did that. That's pretty good for a lunkhead, you know. That are kind of dismissed. We don't even take in these parts of us. They're really quite wonderful. And, you know, if you think about the people here, probably every one of you are really quite wonderful people. You know, I mean, how many people killed something today? Or, you know, I mean, that's one of the precepts, you know. We'd all say, oh, well, I didn't have a bad day. I didn't kill anybody today. I didn't get drunk, you know. I didn't sexually abuse someone. Right? I feel pretty good. There's a spider came down in front of me this morning. I got up about, my son woke me up at 4:30, so I'm kind of wondering whether I'm going to make it through the night or not. But there's a spider coming down in front of me in front of the sink. You know, I feel pretty good because I just let him do his thing, you know, and came back later and he's gone. So, you know, maybe like I really didn't, I could have said a lot worse, you know. I mean, we really don't give ourselves credit for the things we do. And I think it's really useful to kind of reflect on that. Because it generates a good feeling. It's skillful. Now, when I say, is this voice on your side, I think another question is, who is this voice? I mean, when I was a kid, it just really kind of struck me like, there's this one voice that's telling me I should do all these things, and you know, da-da-da. And then there's this other part that's sort of getting beat up, right? And what's going on here? I mean, which one's me? Or who's this other person? You know, they're like little programs that run on, right? And I want to touch a little bit on the talk I gave in September. And that was a whole talk, so I'm going to try and do this in maybe 5 minutes. So, you know, if it doesn't sort of come through, the talk's on Dharma Seed. It's there's nothing wrong with you. Okay. And so one way to look at this inner tyrant, maybe to take a little power out of it, is in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is a discourse on mindfulness. It's actually translated as the presence of mindfulness or attending with mindfulness. The third focus or foundation of the sutta, and this is a very important discourse in the Theravada tradition. So the third foundation is to focus on the mind, citta. So maybe mind-heart. And I haven't brought the sutta with me this time, but it says something like this. Be aware when there's greed. Be aware there's not greed. Be aware when there's hatred and ill will. Be aware when there's not hatred and ill will. Be aware when the mind's distracted. Be aware when the mind's not distracted. And, you know, there's about 16 mind states that are listed in this third foundation. And you get the idea, the Buddha was trying to be all-inclusive. And one of the things that's in there is to be aware when there's delusion and when there's not delusion. And this is a reference to a sense of identity, a sense of self. Okay? So he's saying that this sense of identity, the sense of who we think we are, is in the mind. Okay? So he's saying that the mind and you are not two separate things. You are not having a mental experience. You're being held within the mind as a mental experience. So this inner critic is in the mind. And this inadequate self is in the mind. Okay? Not outside. And this is kind of takes you back a little bit. Because if you're outside the mind, you can control it. You can tweak it some. You can fix it. But this sense of self is one part of the mind bickering with the other part of the mind. And, you know, if you think about it, this is kind of helpful. This is just a thought. It's a little program running. I mean, that's one of the translations of sankharas. It's the one that Ajahn Sucitto uses, which I happen to like. You could call it patterns, but I like program. You know, a little button gets pushed and the inner critic runs, right? You know, you didn't say the right thing. You kind of laugh kind of silly way, or, you know, well, that was really, we've been trained to do this for, you know, depends on how old you are, but most of our lives, right? So what's going on here is there's one part of the mind fighting the other part of the mind. And it's a form of resistance. You never win. In fact, that's what keeps these two parts alive. So, you know, the Buddha says to observe these things, and then in a refrain, which, you know, is repeated after each one, he's focused on the foundations of mindfulness. He said, well, just be aware that it arises, bides, and passes away. Now, that's a useful way to work with the inner critic. Oh, yeah, here you are again. Haven't seen you for a few minutes, right? and it's sort of like it's kind of has some sense of humor. I mean, I watched myself. I was coming over here to teach the elders group yesterday, and I had to go back in the house 4 times. Right? But, you know, I don't beat myself up. I just laugh. I mean, it's just how my mind works, right? It's okay. I mean, it's just what I got. And the older I get, the probably worse it'll get, you know? So he's just saying, just watch it arise, abide, and pass away. And let me keep track of time here a little bit. And sometimes he says, well, just see, there is a mind. So what's watching the mind? There's this quality of awareness, this quality of wholeness that's not divided. And this is really where we want to rest. It's sometimes the language is used to step back from what's going on, not get caught up in all these stories that are going on. But that's doesn't quite capture it, because that's kind of a disengagement. It's really taking a deep interest in what's going on. That these are little parts of ourselves that have been developed out of causes and conditions. And rather than fighting them, it's like, oh, what's it like for you, inner critic? I mean, really to feel that, take it on. What role is it playing? What does it want? You know, these parts kind of evolve for good reason. It's not our fault. It kind of helped us get through life. And the way to free ourselves of them is really to open to them, to allow them to be conscious. Because I hear so much when people say, well, you know, I was judging my practice or my meditation or my concentration wasn't good. And then I thought, oh, I shouldn't be judging myself, right? Everybody nods their head. I've heard that so many times. I mean, it's silly, isn't it? This is the mind talking to the mind. One program ain't saying the other program shouldn't be running. So sometimes it's useful to have some questions. Now, do you view the world of experience that you're having as outside of the mind? All the experience that's going on is inside the mind. And, you know, the Buddha says things like, you don't come to the end of suffering until you can come to the end of the world. And you don't come to the end of the world until you come to the end of this fathom-long body with its perceptions and feelings. So it's a seed that this is really all a construction of the mind. This whole world that causes so much dukkha is constructed in these little programs. So you can ask questions, we can notice we're judging. And we can see that as a program running rather than taking it as some outside, we have a phone ring or something? It's a hearing thing, okay, yeah. Rather than taking it as a some authority out there who's telling us all, they just realize this is a program running. Oh, the judging program's running again, right? We'd be aware that just judging this program is a mental experience. It's just playing out. It just lightens it. We can look at the energy of this energy and language of this inner critic. There's a sense of tightness of the body being right, being compact. There's this language of comparison. You know, am I as attractive as this person, or am I really smart, or am I smarter than this person? And you know, being intelligent is so revered in the society, right? This language of diminishment, never, always. You know, you never do things right, and you always screw this up, right? I mean, it generalizes things. One of the most powerful words it uses is should, where this must be done. And should is just ultimate form of resistance. There's no life in it. There's Marshall Rosenberg who basically has written a lot of stuff and taught a lot on nonviolent communication. I listened to one of his talks and I thought it was quite interesting what he did. He made a list of all the things he should do. And then he said, I should do these things because. Okay. So, you know, he's a psychologist, therapist of some sort. And so after he sees a client, he used to have to write up a diagnosis. And we ask himself, well, why do I write up this diagnosis? He said, well, because I get paid for it, right? I mean, he hates writing these diagnoses. And so he decided that he'd rather live in rags than write these diagnoses again. And so he quit doing it. And he said, you know, it was the greatest decision I ever made. And then some of the things he wrote, you know, that I should do this was really because he loved doing it. Okay. And that's really where we want to move. We want to move out of a place of really love, something that really moves the heart. And some of the things we do, maybe they're not very pleasant, but we do it because we know that the results of it are beneficial for ourselves or for someone else. So in his particular example, he drives his son to this private school, and it's quite a long drive, and he does this every day. And you know, for a while he's kind of doing it with some aversion and grumbling about it. And then he thought, you know, I do this because I really value my son getting a good education to be in a good environment. And so he reminds himself every day why he does this. Now, you know, we can do this. I mean, sometimes we do things we don't like. We don't really want to do it, but you kind of say, well, you know, I'm doing this because I, you know, support my family and I really care about them. Or, I don't know, you can pick your own examples, right? But I think it's a useful thing, just why you think you should do things. And see how much of it's because you need someone else's approval. You need to be accepted. And how much because it really resonates with you. As usual, I'm getting in trouble on time. This is all very useful, but it's all heady still. And really, one of the problems is we spend so much time up in this head in the world of concepts. So in Buddhism, there are really kind of three systems of intelligence would be one way to talk about it, or programs, or sankharas. So there's this conceptual piece. It's very useful. Plan, organize, solve, problem solving. And then there is the heart piece that I've talked about. And then there's a body, kaya sankhara. And so our practice is to really learn to experience their life through all these systems of intelligence. I mean, the body has an intelligence. This quality of heart has an intelligence. You can notice how the body responds. I mean, it's responsive to things. You know, if there's fear, you watch what happens to the breathing, or anger, or when there's a sense of ease, how the breathing. So it's affected and responsive to what's going on. And being aware of that felt sense in the body is really important. It's our ground. And when we're not grounded in the body, we live up in this conceptual world. And the only way this conceptual world has any ground is by constantly spinning, constantly moving, thinking. And for one thing, it uses up a tremendous amount of energy. I mean, it's amazing the amount of blood vessels that go up to the head. I mean, you come home from work, you know, you haven't really done anything physically, but you're exhausted, right? And the other reason you kind of want to be in the body is that this head sort of spins around. It always finds trouble somewhere, right, eventually. So we're kind of disassociated from our other parts. And it's not really our fault. I mean, this society is so, most of us have jobs that require being in a conceptual world. Okay? But what we want to do is move to a greater balance, to learn to be in the body. And as I'm talking now, I mean, sort of, well, I've been kind of been up in the head, sort of spinning away, and then just for a moment, just, can you just feel, you know, maybe the buttocks sitting on the cushion. Can you just feel the breath moving? And everything kind of slows down. There's a sense of ease from that. So it's really useful to pay attention to the body because it has an intelligence. We can't fool ourselves. It's not some story we can make up. And what do things feel like from a bodily sense? I mean, I think if we pay attention, we can see what it feels like to be angry or to want something really badly, or so, you know, we can ask, well, is the body, does it feel welcomed? Does it feel at ease, balanced? Or does it feel tilted, tight, compacted, contracted? You know, do we feel rested? Or do we feel we have to prove or fix something? That we're okay or accomplish something or get rid of something? And when we feel that way, the body's contracted. And when the body's contracted, you'll never find peace and ease in your meditation. When you sit and I've got to accomplish this, I've got to concentrate, it just doesn't work. I mean, so what we want to do is learn to just relax. So this is kind of the other response to this split mind, is just to relax, and the awareness is there. And it's such a shift from I've got to be mindful to just relaxing and let the awareness just show up for you. The energy is entirely different. And you just can't be mindful all the time. I mean, if you're, you know, the very trying to be mindful, to be aware of what's going on all the time, creates a sense of stress. And you can do it for a while, but the energy runs out. Okay. And when the body is contracted, this heart sense is contracted. There's no sense of love and compassion, no sense of abundance, of ease. It tends to be dismissive, irritable. So it's really helpful to relax the body because then the heart begins to feel better. And when the heart feels contracted, it's the source of wanting to do things or fix things. Like, this doesn't feel right. Okay. And sometimes it's very helpful. It gets us here, right? That's why a lot of people come here, because things just don't feel quite right. There's got to be something better than this. And so rather than do and fix, what we want to do is come to the body and see if we can get in touch with things. And sometimes it's helpful just... And so these three systems, this conceptual part, this heart piece, and the body all interact. They influence each other. And we can use them together skillfully. So, you know, maybe the heart sense, oh, this doesn't feel well. And this conceptual piece can actually, you know, help some. It can say, oh, how's my breathing in this? Just to come into the body and just feel how it is. Or maybe, how am I with this? It's a way to kind of disengage. So, disengage is not a good word. It's a way to not be lost in what's going on. To be connected but not lost in it. And so what this means is that when we have difficult emotions, that we need to find a way to open to them. Because the conceptual piece, what it wants to do, things feel unpleasant, we move up into the head, try and fix, distract. And when we do that, the body tightens up and the heart feels contracted and we never really feel satisfied. This is actually what's called karma. And this is a really tricky topic, so I want to maybe say a few things about it, and if it doesn't resonate, maybe we'll try that next time. But karma in Buddhism is action. It's not fate or something like that. And it one aspect of karma is the intention to do something or the motivation or volition. And so when the heart is touched by something, it could be some thought about, oh, this doesn't feel good, or, you know, I want that. It could be internal, or it could be external, or it sees something it wants, or it feels threatened. That triggers volition or intention, the initiation of action, of karma. And the result of that intention or volition is old karma. Actually, the Pali word is kama, and vipaka is the result. So cause and effect is very important in Buddhism. And so, a path to awakening is to see how this volition gets initiated. It gets initiated because the heart sense doesn't feel good. And so it really part of the awakening process is start noticing, oh, things don't feel right. And rather than trying to fix them, to get away from things, we want to open up to what's there and bring tremendous kindness and compassion to it. I gave a talk last night, so I don't have a lot of new examples. I'll just use an old one, I guess. I had this, you know, quite some time ago. My wife was really, we have a son with Asperger's who's bipolar. Took a lot of her energy to raise him. And I felt very alone because she was just not available. And, you know, what we do so often when we're feeling lonely or angry or what is we try and do something about it, right? And so, you know, maybe we go out and try and get into another relationship or find some way to distract yourself. But I really took it on just to feel that loneliness. Feel it in the body and not push it away. And it was just amazing because over time, what happened was that I realized I didn't really need someone to fill me up. It's like an old program that's around. And of course, I should know that. I go off on 3-month retreats. I'm delighted being by myself. So, and it changed everything. rather than meeting out of need and trying to get filled up, we just connected out of joy. And this is not easy. So I don't think one, don't start judging yourself about, oh, well, I can't be with these feelings. Because, you know, in Buddhism, suppression actually can be a positive thing. You know, we kind of open up to things when we're capable of opening up to them. And so it just takes some patience and perseverance to be with things and some skill. So that's the awakening part, to see how volition or intention arises, and then not to follow it, not to move out of the sense of identity, out of aversion or craving or desire, but to open what's there and to bring about kindness and compassion. And the second path factor, the Eightfold Path, is can be translated as wise intention or right intention. I like the word harmonious intention. And the positive aspects of intention are kindness, compassion, and the words used is renunciation, which, you know, everybody threatens to give a talk on renunciation, but none of us do it because we figure nobody will show up. But, you know, one way to look at it is simplicity. Really not to have so many needs. And when there's this quality of kindness and compassion, when there's a simplicity, there isn't a need to do. There is a sense of peace, of abundance, that things are just fine the way they are. And then it's not that we don't ever do anything. We move from a very different place. Okay? So I may want to close a little bit by just saying a little bit more about this karma. And about the importance of being in the body, is that every time we make an action where we resist something, it gets registered in the body. There's a tightening, we hold our shoulders up or hunch over. There's actually a beautiful cartoon where Charlie Brown's walking along with Lucy, I guess, is that right? Yeah. And he's slumped over and she says, you know, if you just stood up straight, you wouldn't be so depressed. And and Charlie said, well, I don't really want to let go of my depression. But you know, it's not that simple, but it really is important about how we hold our body. And it's so, you know, most of us aren't even touched with our lower body. I mean, how many people can feel their toes? Or, you know, we don't notice how we tighten our buttocks up or the belly's tight. And I've been actually doing a lot of work in the last, I guess really 3 or 4 months, just doing body scans to look at these parts and just, because there's awareness all through the body, but we've kind of deadened it because of all this resistance. And you sort of open up, there's just so much more there. So let me just read a little comment by Trungpa Rinpoche, who's from Tibetan tradition. And he's asked about karma. And he says, how do you exhaust karma? And his response was, when things come up in your life, you feel them completely and fully, and you don't hold back. You live them right through until they have completed themselves. And it's interesting, Shunryu Suzuki, in his Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which many of us love, says to burn every moment. To be completely here. And if you're fixing and da-da, you're not here. Okay. So this is a comment by Reginald Ray, who's a Tibetan teacher and was a student of Rinpoche, of Trungpa. This applies to whatever is arising for us. Not just what is painful, but what is pleasurable as well. When we are blissful and happy, we go along to a certain point, but then we pull back because we are afraid. Perhaps it is too much, and we feel we are losing our sense of self. this identity that this inner tyrant constructs. Or perhaps we are afraid it will slip away. This is because true bliss and true happiness, perhaps even more so than pain, are a negation of the human ego. So our practice is to be present, to open right in this very moment, to have an approach of being in harmony with these three forms of intelligence, and to feel what's there rather than to try and move away and change things. And this allows the unconscious to become conscious. And when that happens, the body opens up and there's greater ease. So this inner tyrant, you know, is kind of both the footprint and, now I'm losing my language here, and result of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's embodied. This inner tyrant is embodied. And it's also affected by the inner tyrant. So when we're angry, desirous, the body tightens up. The body tightens up, the heart contracts. There's a sense of dissatisfaction. And when the body's tight and the heart's contracted, then, yeah, we move up to the mind because it doesn't feel good. So that's how it plays out. So thank you for the evening. I hope this was helpful. And just take a few minutes for people to stretch and people want to leave.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.